You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Are millennials giving top marks to Marx, or could they be more libertarian than we think? I'm Darren Grimes, Digital Manager at the Institute of Economic Affairs, and today I'm joined by Rebecca Lowe, Director of FREIA, and Madeline Grant, the Editorial Manager at the IEA. They put the stereotype of the millennial Marxist under the spotlight and examine where things may not be so clear-cut. Finally, they look at the ways free marketeers can craft a positive case for capitalism. For more podcasts, films, and reports, go to our website at iea.org.uk. We had a brief conversation yesterday in the pub in which we outlined the sort of general direction of what today's talk will be. And Rebecca pointed out that this year, Karl Marx's 200th birthday, and at the 170th anniversary of the Communist Manifesto, actually. Mm. Now, we all know the cliche of the socialist millennial that gives top marks to Marx, but this seems to be broadly correct. If you look at survey evidence, for example, in a recent YouGov survey, supporters of socialism outnumber critics in a ratio of about 2-1. As supporters of free markets and free people, that is pretty terrifying. But do you think, Rebecca, that the cliche, you know, 170 years on from the Communist Manifesto, is actually as strong as people make out?
It's a really interesting question. And certainly with FREIA, the bit of the IEA that I run, we've actually just done a bit of our own polling on this. It's going to be coming out in the next couple of weeks in a paper Lee Rowley has written. I don't want to give too much away, but I think there are some positives to take from that. And to my mind, it comes back to, I always get a little bit bogged down in sort of wanting to define terms, but I think if you want to talk about people's perception about an ideology, you need to know what it is they're thinking about. Now, I have a left-wing friend who says it's really unfair that Marx gets to determine what socialism is. You know, this idea that it's all about the means of production and it's about taking things into national ownership. He says, no, socialism is about realising the common good and we all want to do that. Mm. And I think this is actually a really key point, because if you think about some of these people, these younger people, or indeed other people in society who maybe feel they don't have access, say, to capital in the sense of a house, or maybe they feel that they're not sort of reaping the rewards that they think that they deserve, then the question is, well, what exactly is it they think socialism would offer for them? Do they want their houses to be requisitioned, for instance? I think they probably don't. And then if you think, well, if it's about, if we go back to the kind of this idea from Marx that it's about taking controls of the means of production in the sense of, if you want to think about, I don't know, public utilities, some people might say, well, yeah, sure, the trains aren't working. Now, my argument would be that's not because we have a private system which is flourishing and working well. I think, if anything, it needs more liberalisation. We have a kind of state-run franchise system. Similarly, in terms of other utilities, you get a lot of people saying the problem is that it needs to go into national ownership to make it more efficient. The arguments are very strong that it would not make it more efficient. So do these people really think they're going to gain benefits? Would they, for instance, want the airlines to be taken into national ownership if the prices went up? I think people do care about what the effects of these things are. And there's a difference between an ideology that people are committed to because they think it sounds nice, or indeed even because maybe it is nice, maybe it is indeed there to emancipate people, and then what the effects of trying to impose this kind of thing, whether because you can't impose something like that, or whether because indeed it is actually intrinsically flawed.
Yeah, I think, can I come in on that?
Of course.
I've made this point about, you know, when has socialism ever worked? People will say, oh, well, it's never, you know, it's never been tried properly. But they certainly would not consider a Venezuela an example of the kind of socialist society they want.
Yeah.
And that's partly, I think that is actually at the heart of why that particular brand of political messaging, whenever it's been tried by the Conservative Party, has failed. Because people go, what an older generation would consider a cautionary tale of socialism, for example, three-day power cuts in the 1970s or Venezuela today, people say, oh, well, that's not my socialism. And for them, they feel that their views are being strawmanned by that cliche. So there's a really important point here about the kind of anti-socialist messaging that you apply. What Rebecca's doing that's so important with FREIA is trying to figure out where some of the nuances may lie in people's views, where they may be more capitalist or more libertarian than we think, but also how to craft a narrative that properly attributes the results of capitalism, the products and services that we all enjoy, with capitalism, rather than allowing people to believe that they could somehow exist in a socialist society and still have many of the things that they take for granted.
I mean, staying on that really important point, because I think actually one thing I took away from Conservative Party conference this year, and mainly at FRIA events. FRIA really, I think, had its finger on the pulse, because the diagnosis I took away from those events was that it all comes down to values, right? And we are not making, we on the free market right, are not making the positive case for a market economy. We just seem to have left the battlefield. And we're not showing how Britain's worst economic and social problems can all be addressed within the framework of a market economy. Instead, you know, millennials are, I guess, enamoured by the idea of a socialism quite different than the centralised freak show that we see in Venezuela. And they don't actually see it as their socialism or real socialism. So how can we frame the debate?
If you look at the popular left-wing thinkers of today, a lot of their narrative involves distancing themselves from Venezuela, despite the fact that, you know, until the day before yesterday, many of their top people were arguing that we should not just, you know, look to Venezuela as an example of where socialism is thriving, but we should actually apply some of the policies that have been tried and tested in Venezuela over here. So it's all a bit, it's like crocodile tears to hear people now pretending that Venezuela is very much not what they're arguing for. But it is also about changing the language around communism. So they talk a lot about, you know, an inclusive form of socialism where we could involve people at all levels of the process, the kind of democratic socialism model. But as people like Christian Niemitz have proven so well, that would be incredibly dysfunctional. It would be, you know, impossible to have so much collectivized, but also have so much being democratically decided. You'd have to have referenda on the production of all sorts of things. You'd have to have referenda on how many toasters, how many pizzas were being manufactured, how many toothbrushes, and all this kind of stuff. I mean, this is the actual nitty gritty of this process is ridiculous, but the language sounds very, very nice indeed. And it's, I guess, what we should do is we should really call people to account about how they would actually propose to implement their process.
I think we also just need to be more honest about what the specific problems we are that we face. So, for instance, if we go back to some of these ideas about, you know, utility companies you know, the train lines, and we need to say, no, they're not allowed to run the narrative on this and say it's a problem with a free market system, when indeed it's not actually a free market system. I think the point about values you say is so key. And that's why I'm really, really keen, particularly with FRIA and as with everything we do, to point out that some of these things are so fundamentally important that they should not be beset by party politics. It is in everybody's interest to be free, to be able to make choices. And as I said, you know, people like Marx, socialist philosophers throughout time, have often been trying to emancipate people in a different kind of way from maybe those people on a sort of different side of the spectrum. But most people, when they're trying to look to society to try to work out how to make it better, that's because they believe that people have, you know, the ability to have a good life. Now, somebody like Marx comes along and brings in this kind of scientific determinism, and this leads to all kinds of people having these crazy ideas that, you know, we can't actually take the control of our own lives. But giving people a stake in their own life, whether that's through recognising the benefits of the market, whether that's recognising that we need to free things up so that they can take part in free exchange and free enterprise, or indeed, like Maddie's intimating, about having a bigger kind of democratic voice. To my mind, the benefits of free market capitalism are not just the instrumental benefits you get in terms of like the improvements to goods and services. It's intrinsically good because this stuff is predicated on the idea that we're autonomous creatures who are free to make choices about our own lives, because that's just recognising our dignity as individuals. Now, I think part of the problem we face at the moment is we have a highly centralised country in which people feel as if their say in local areas it's just not heard, whether that's in terms of matching their preferences, in terms of kind of Thibault sorting and sort of local government actually having a stake. If you look at something like our highly centralised tax system, no wonder people don't care about local government.
Yeah, and I think perhaps the most crucial one of these is the housing crisis. And we live in a society in Britain that is obviously, you know, broadly capitalist. But within that, there are some seriously dysfunctional areas of public policy where certainly we believe that the government has come in and created a dysfunctional mess. And the housing crisis is perhaps the best and the most dangerous example of this, where there are specific government imposed obstacles to house building that have existed since the 1940s. And because we've been, obviously, they date back to Clement Attlee's government. They are socialist. That's a socialist mindset that dictated the Town and Country Planning Act. But of course, we're living with the repercussions of that today. Mm-hmm. And you can quite understand why many young people would live in the Britain that we live in today and see a clear, you know, a market failure, albeit not a market failure, a market that is failing due to specific government policies. But you can understand how people would look at that and say, well, look, clearly capitalism has failed.
Exactly.
And I think it's deeply ironic that for the housing crisis, which is a problem that ultimately stems from government, the solutions are so often status solutions. It's all about the government building more council homes and stuff like that.
It's this deceit that the state always has our best interests at heart, whereas all too often the kind of crony type capitalism we have is something which means that the big players with their vested interests can lobby the state to have higher forms of regulation which keep out the, you know, the small business or the individual consumer.
Well, I think the 2 points, the nationalisation of the railways and indeed in the housing market, you know, there's no reason why housing markets work perfectly all right in most of the developed world. It's a political choice.
As Maddie said, this is a point about government-imposed obstacles. To my mind, there is this deceit that the idea if things are not working well, the state will come in and make it better. Whereas all too often, the kind of crony system we have is one which preferences big players with their vested interests, not only the current system, but they lobby to increase regulations for barriers to entry for smaller players.
I mean, my mind goes straight back to after Labour Party conference, I think it was in Liverpool this year, and there'd been absolute murder on the trains because of a signalling error. And Jeremy Corbyn immediately got to his Twitter account and tweeted saying, this is exactly why Labour needs to nationalise the railways. And everyone on the right, or anyone in the know, I guess, replied with, That's down to Network Rail, which is nationalised.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, was never privatised. And it's because of this botched job with privatisation that we have a market that isn't functioning right.
That's right. It's a state-run franchise system where basically all is happening. The only point at which there's any competition is people to get the original franchise, which means that they're basically, the person that they're serving, the consumer, is the state. It's a monopsony and a monopoly. I mean,
why are we not making this argument? Why are we not
fighting this?
This
is my point about talking about what the genuine truths are. All too often, we're too keen to say, oh, we've lost in it. I mean, the NHS is the classic area. We've lost in this thing. There's no point in us talking about what we could do to fix things. We're not going to win that one.
That Network Rail example is such a brilliant one because it's not only an example of the deceit, i.e. a problem that stems from state, and then you have a statist who says that the answer to that is more state. It could not be more dishonest if it tried. But if you're on top of the facts and if you're able to come back with a compelling narrative, that's a great example of how you can actually bat that kind of nonsense into the long grass. And that's what we need to be doing more of.
So even on something like water, you get the classic argument, it's like, oh, well, it's a natural monopoly in terms of, you know, if you have one set of pipes. That doesn't mean there aren't any places where you can have competition to drive down prices. You can have it in terms of how you store it or how you measure readings. The idea that certain things are in the domain of the state, sure, we might all say, for instance, you know, we want the army to be in the domain of the state. There's also a point, though, about who owns something, who works within something, who profits for something. You know, we're all too often just give this stuff away. It's a bit like, again, my left-wing friend who says, you know, why let Marx have the monopoly on determining what the social good is?
Well, industry nationalisations, price controls and rent controls are all particularly popular. If, like us, like everyone in this room, you associate socialism with queuing, rationing and bureaucratic control, then it seems pretty strange, actually, that these things, and scary, actually, that these things are popular, because people actually believe that their version of socialism is different. You know, it's not like the countless
versions. But we have proof that all of these things don't
work.
I mean, rent control is a classic example. Find me an example where that's helped the little guy.
Yeah. It's one of those very rare, rent control is one of those very rare issues where you can find economists from across the political spectrum agreeing on how terrible they are.
Yeah.
It's actually so rare that you have an issue that so fails to divide economists who famously have, you know, more opinions than they know what to do with.
Well, I mean, why are we, if this is the generation of, as Freer would very much advocate, the generation of Uber riding, Airbnb-ing, Deliveroo eating freedom fighters, where did we get it so wrong? Where did we go so wrong?
I think that we went wrong partly in allowing left-wing arguments to dominate the narrative and that to become the default. I mean, at some point, there must have been a time in the debate about the National Health Service where free marketeers decided, actually, no, it's fine, we'll let this one die. You know, it's fine. We will sign up to statism. I think that part of it comes from the fact that people actually don't have to live in a society where these things are nationalised. I saw some polling not long ago which showed just a really staggering amount of things that people would be very happy with nationalising. So obviously railways are extremely popular. That's no secret. Something like 80%, possibly more, of people would like to nationalise them. But it's also utterly ludicrous things. Like something like 25% of people wanted to nationalise travel agents.
Well, Thomas Cook used to be on the list if you go down and look at all of the list of things that over time, you're starting the 1940s onwards, is basically an onslaught of a couple of
And I think actually if you've told a millennial, they'll have to wait up to 6 months to have a telephone line installed.
Oh, they would be furious.
The embarrassing thing is people don't even use travel agents. Yeah. We're cutting out the middleman. This is the beauty of the peer-to-peer economy.
We don't cut
transaction costs by cutting out these middlemen. Yeah.
But it's great. Like, we don't have any travel agents, but let's nationalise them anyway.
Yes. You know,
like, this is crazy.
Because it sounds nice.
Yeah.
We have allowed the left wing to win over the side that they are on the side of the good. This all too often is what is won. And, you know, partly I think this is a fault of economists who are consequentialists all too often and focus just on endpoints and on mathematical arguments and on modelling and statistics and saying, you know, this brings about this and this, as opposed to looking at some of the fundamental principles underneath about why that stuff might be important. Crazily, it turns out that saying X number of billion people taken out of poverty, whether even if you pick up individual stories, you take a woman in sub-Saharan Africa who's less likely to die in childbirth, or you look at somebody in more developed society who, you know, maybe they didn't do very well at school, but goes on and is a massive success, and that has a knock-on effect, their startup works. Nonetheless, we're all too often just focusing on these endpoints. If we say, why is it that this is important? Not just because of the consequences, but because we are human beings with autonomy who deserve to have a chance to determine how our life goes. I think we don't do a very good job of doing that.
What about things like taxation, for example? The narrative is very much that corporation tax is this big bad wolf, and actually we're allowing corporations to get away with not paying it. But actually evidence has shown that the reduction in corporation tax since 2010 has meant a lot more
revenues.
Income for the
exactly.
Treasury, more jobs, better wages, but that's not a narrative that's cutting through.
Well, I think that actually gets to the heart of another issue we face, that the narrative has overall prosperity doesn't matter to these people. They're far more concerned about inequality. They would rather that we had fewer tax receipts, provided corporations were paying.
They want to
more.
Level down. They just
yeah.
want...
It's that they want the, I mean, they don't think of it like this, but ultimately what they want is the, you know, as Churchill put it, the equal sharing of misery. They actually would be comfortable with a less prosperous society overall, because they've actually stopped, interestingly, in the way that poverty is being measured. We've moved from measuring absolute poverty to looking at relative poverty.
Yes.
And I think that's changed. That's helped to reframe the debate in this way. But there is one area that I think is like we've really failed when it comes to housing.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't blame any young person who, I disagree with them, but you can't call young socialists stupid for being railing against the system when it's so firmly stacked against that generation due to the housing crisis. And I think that if issues like the housing crisis were sorted out, my guess is that we'd pretty soon find out that many millennials' commitment to socialism is actually pretty skin deep.
Is it too reductive to say that we'd pretty quickly find out that millennials' views of socialism is more of a fashion statement than anything else if the housing crisis were to be sorted?
That's interesting, isn't it? I think millennials, and I think most people, are interested in, you know, furthering the common good and these ideas of, you know, people are interested in equality, and any way of evaluating the economic welfare of a country that doesn't take into consideration some questions of distribution, some questions of relative positioning on the scale, is not going to be a full account. But that must not be the most important thing that we look at. Living standards across the board have to be our greatest consideration. I think it's perfectly legitimate, however, to say we feel that some people in society don't have as much of a purchase on the way their life goes, whether that's because they feel democracy isn't sort of equally spread. And I'll come back to this point about the high focus of centralization we have in this country. But in terms of people's access to, you know, to good goods and services, we know that the market economy is the thing that spontaneously brings about the best results. We don't always do a very good job of selling that.
There will undoubtedly be someone that replies to this podcast and says, well, what about Scandinavia? What do you say to that?
Well, Scandinavia is a great red herring. This is, I think, relates to the point about taking things for granted, that there's this feeling that you could somehow undo all of the essential freedoms of a capitalist society and still end up at the same result. And one of the red herrings that has tricked people into thinking that you could actually achieve this is the example set by the Scandinavian countries. what's really going on with these places is that they are extremely economically free countries that after the event happen to have quite high levels of wealth redistribution. You know, it's not that well known that Sweden doesn't have a minimum wage. Norway I think it's a terrible example generally to use. It's a real anomaly because it has a vast sovereign oil wealth fund and it has a population of 4 million people. The idea that a country like, you know, an average country that doesn't have those kind of resources could suddenly overnight switch to a Nordic model when in fact it's sitting on its own giant welfare fund. and granted, their politicians have been very clever in the way that they've invested their sovereign wealth fund, very responsible, and they've made some very good
decisions.
Unlike
Venezuela.
Well, quite. But it's still, it's not... It's very bad. It's very bad economics, I think, to be comparing a normal test country with somewhere like Norway. And there's actually a great deal of private provision that goes on in these countries that the kind of centralised left wingers in this country would be horrified. You know, I think in Britain it's something like 8% of our healthcare is privately provided. It may actually be less than that. In Sweden, it's between 20% and 30%. Now you try and also their education system is from the Milton Friedman playbook. You know, you try telling left wingers in Britain that yes, you can have Scandinavia, but we also have to make it an extremely free country that doesn't. We can abolish the minimum wage tomorrow and go into a private voucher system for education. I don't think they'd be particularly happy about it.
So what's it going to take for people to wake up and smell the coffee? Do we have to have a dose of socialism? Do we have to go through that? What we all know throughout, you know, reams and reams of evidence would be a complete and utter disaster for this country. What's it going to take for people to wake up and smell the socialist coffee?
It's a really interesting question. And I mean, you know, going back to the point about housing, it seems to be the case that, you know, consensus is only growing about the nature of this problem when we realise what a high level of crisis we're facing, when it is that people realise that, you know, maybe they've got a home, but their kid is never going to have a home. And I just hope, I have great faith in human nature, that it shouldn't be the case that it's only when we have complete devastation that we come to realise that that a system is, you know, why a system might be broken. I think we should be able to see things earlier than that. And yeah, we should be able to look through history. But I keep coming back to these points about we need to be able to diagnose why it is that the things that aren't working in a society aren't working, rather than accepting some kind of sticking plaster message which is created by somebody with their own interests at heart.
The question is, you know, are millennials more libertarian than we think? I think they may be more libertarian than they think they are. But unfortunately, I think as long as the housing crisis persists in this current vein, and so many people feel that they are not true players in British society, that they, you know, they've no stake in society, and how can you encourage people to, as has been said many times before, how can people be capitalists without any capital? So I think the housing crisis really does go to the heart of everything. And for, I think most young people, even if in opinion polls they give some, you know, pretty ignorant ideas about, you know, let's nationalise Thomas Cook again, most people, in practice, as Rebecca says, do not think like that. So I think there is a potential to harness this feeling amongst people who are already in so many ways benefiting from the free market. But it's just the housing crisis is such a big one. It has such knock-on effects for all other areas of life, for our feeling of our sense of self, sense of community, our spending in other areas, because people can be spending more than half of their wages on housing. It has huge implications for productivity because it's harder for people to move to take the jobs that they want. I just cannot stress how much it trickles down and affects every other area of economic and social life. So I think that until we really get that problem solved, and luckily I think that even amongst the Conservative Party, which have traditionally opposed Greenbelt building, I think we are starting to see some glimmers of hope.
So Rebecca, I wonder if you can conclude then whether or not you are optimistic that we are going to actually start making those value-based arguments that you argue so eloquently for.
That's very kind. I hope so. I think I'm an optimist. Mm-hmm. I think just actually to touch on something Maddie just said, the polling that we've done for Freer that Matt Singh at Number Crunch Politics has done, which we're going to be revealing in the next few weeks, one of the positive messages, if we can see it as positive, is the overall answer to what would make you more in favour of capitalism, and of course all kinds of caveats about what people understand by that. The overall message was a point about fairness. It was a point about big corporations. It was a point about them being aware of their environmental footprint and treating workers better, the kind of answers you might well expect. And we can talk all day about whether these are fair criticisms or not. And but within younger people, there was indeed a demand for some kind of retail offer. It was a point about wanting access to the housing market, etc. And I think that's probably not because young people are more greedy. I think it's that they've just grown used to having great goods and services.
And it's framed as a giveaway, but it's not in fact a giveaway. They're wanting a fair whack at an area of you know, a crucial area of their lives that is currently being denied to them due to these ridiculous blockages that exist in our system. So I don't think that's being like, where's my house? I deserve a house. I think they can see that the system is so unfairly rigged against them. It's just that unfortunately they have not correctly diagnosed the cause of that problem.
After speaking to the two of you, I feel a hell of a lot more confident that socialism is only skin deep and we can get out there and make the case. And I just hope others will join us in making the arguments, because if not, as Rebecca just set out so well there, we are up the Swanee, as it were. But anyway, thank you so much, Maddie and Rebecca.
Thanks, Darren.
Thanks, Darren.
If you like what you hear, be sure to subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations.